Last speaker of the symposium is Gerge Orban from our department, head of the Computational System Neuroscience Research Group. He is also a physicist, but he moved to computational neuroscience long ago. So he got his PhD at the Aalto University in 2000, then started to work for KFKI, then moved to Berlin as a Humboldt Fellow, and later to the US, and then Cambridge as a postdoc. And now he is working for our back again here at the Wiener Institute. But beforehand, he was also a Marie Curie Fellow. At the moment, his group is also a Lendület Impact Research Group of the Hungarian Academy of Sciences. So the floor is yours, Jörg.
Lovely, thank you very much. I think the sound is good. Okay, so welcome to the last talk of this conference. I reckon it's not too late to switch topics. So I guess that I have exactly like minus 9 minutes to complete the talk, so I will do my best to do this time travel. So my group is working at the interface of artificial intelligence and biological intelligence, and these two topics share a lot of things. A lot of things are common in them. The key principle is that that we want to understand how intelligence works, and this way there is a lot of crosstalk and cross fertilization between these two fields. And now we'll attempt to share some insights about what sort of contributions machine learning and artificial intelligence can make to understanding biological intelligence. So if we look at this problem of trying to understand what's going on here when we perceive something in the environment and then try to make decisions, then it can be parcelated into different subproblems, like perceiving and making actions. In the case of from the neuroscience point of view, what we have is a zillion of neurons that are crying like babies losing their tummies, and we want to figure out why they are doing that. So here I will try to highlight two different approaches. One of them is something that I will call data-driven, and the other one is called adaptation-driven. So the first one is actually this, the thing that is the most common way of approaching the problem, which is that we have a particular task, like a mouse is shown visual and auditory stimuli, and neurons respond. And according to the neuron doctrine, you want to understand what the responses individual neurons would give. And what you will find is that some neurons, like the cell A, will be selected for the visual stimulus. So the dark one and the light one are the two different stimuli that we show to the animal. This one is not selected to auditory stimulus, but not too much selective. At the end, it will be selected to the choice the animal makes. And some of these neurons will be actually selected to the sort of thing that the animal is required to do. So this animal is actually doing two different tasks. In one case, the animal needs to pay attention or make decisions based on the visual content, and in the other case, based on the auditory content. Now, from the neuron doctrine point of view, these neurons show this thing that we call mixed selectivity. So all of these guys are selected to pretty much everything, which is, well, might be good. On the other hand, it's also disheartening a bit because it's sort of an answer like whatever that a particular neuron is giving. If you observe the intensity of the response, you will not be able to tell what's going on. But when we apply some sort of machine learning techniques, then what turns out that out of this jungle of responses, with pretty simple ideas, one can figure out that one can find a low dimensional subspace in which these apparently confusing stimuli are somehow organized. Here I'm showing that in this two dimensional subspace, the visual stimulus, which is on the horizontal axis, and the game that the animal is playing are nicely separated. So the dots are the individual trials and along these dimensions, we show the response intensity of a specific combination of neurons. So this is a population response, which is cool on one hand, because it is interpretable. It is good in the sense that if one wants to make a brain-machine interface, then these sort of low-dimensional representations will be robust to electrode movements. So this way, it will be easier to track what's going on in the head of the animal after a couple of days as well. But another benefit that I will just highlight here is that if you have this simple vector space where things are residing in orthogonal subspaces, then one can expect that this neuron population will do some nice vector algebra. And the cool thing is that one can actually analyze this thing and come to the conclusion that it is indeed the case, and that when animals are performing some fancy task, then their neural circuits are performing linear algebra. So this is one sort of takeaway. This is a data-driven approach, and one can figure out some sort of simpler principles along which these neuron populations can make computations. The other approach is the sort of thing that I call adaptation-driven. So here, as Tony phrased it nicely, one can phrase a task that an artificial agent or a biological agent is trying to perform. In this case, let's consider the task of classify observations into either jaguars or tigers, and then this will be a highly nonlinear transformation that the animal that the animal needs to do when observing this particular image. And the way we approach understanding what this thing might be is that we assume that this whole thing was adapted to natural images. So this way, the natural images will constrain how this thing works, and then we will relate to this thing to that thing which we call the brain. Okay, and this can be pretty successful. So if you train your network on a bunch of data, and you try to predict the responses of a particular neuron to like 1600 different images, and you see that so this is one particular neuron here in this region called the infratemporal cortex, and the predicted and actual neural responses on these images, which were not part of the training set, are pretty accurate, which is cool. So the question is then, is this the end of the story or not? Going along with the story of Tony 20 minutes before, we can identify a problem here. So the nervous system is not necessarily interested in this simple task of making inferences about what species the thing that we see belongs to. Rather, it is interested in a bunch of other things like what the posture of this thing might be, because in one case the animal is more prone to attack, in another case less. So, or we want to make finer grain inferences about what's in the in the image. Now, the idea here is that it is sort of the hierarchy of the visual cortex that tries to solve this problem, and the thing that we want to end up with is an inference machine that is not ending up with inferences about one particular set of features, the species, rather a hierarchy of these features. Now, it turns out that if we want to build such a machine, Some of the architectures that Tony was also referring to was is less effective or incapable to do so, and some of them are better. The interesting thing is that when you phrase it the problem as you want to achieve this task, then you end up with a specific architecture that would be good to perform this task. And it turns out that the fact that I will just draw your attention to one particular feature is that this architecture is not feed-forward architecture anymore, but it has connections that go from higher level layers of computations to the lower layers, which is nicely reminiscent of the way the brain works. In the visual cortex, most of the connections that reach the primary visual cortex are not coming from the retina. Instead, those connections come from higher visual areas. And the fun is that without having this sort of principle in mind, there is no normative reason to come up with this thing that we need these top-down connections. So in the remaining part of my talk, I will just highlight three specific ideas that relate to performing these sort of probabilistic computations, and which have some direct consequences on how we read the neural code. The first one is approximate inference. So when we want to do inferences, we want to end up with some sort of a posterior over what features are there in our image. And the probabilistic inference results in not a single point estimate, rather it defines a whole distribution of possible interpretations of the image. Now, this is something that we expect our neurons to do. So they need to represent this distribution. And machine learning instructs us that if you want to do inference, it can be really, really hard. And a way to perform this inference is approximate inference. And one form of approximate inference is sampling, stochastic sampling. The idea behind stochastic sampling is that instead of representing this whole distribution as a whole, instead you build a histogram. Now, if you look at what neurons do when you present an image to them, you will see that for two different images, one particular neuron will respond with two different mean activation levels. But in a finer grained look at it, you will see that this response is actually changing. If we draw up this picture in detail, we see that the joint distribution of these two neurons can actually be the sort of distribution that we want to approximate. So this is just a sort of highlighting this idea that the response variability that we see in neurons can be related to subjective uncertainty. There's plenty of evidence that this is the case. So it's just a nice story about it. The other part that I will highlight here is contextual prior. So when we learn about our environment, this learning explores the regularities that we have in the environment. And these regularities can change from context to context. For instance, if you look at the natural image like this, different portions of the image are characterized by different statistics. So if you have two just linear filters like these two guys, and we look at the co-activations of these two filters in this portion of the image or at this portion of the image, the co-activations will show different shapes or correlations. Okay, so this is some sort of a regularity that is characteristic of a texture family, right? Now this is from a neurons to be present. So when they understand that we are looking at the bark of an oak tree or the bark of a cherry tree, they use these regularities. And this way, we expect that their joint distribution, in the primary visual cortex, will reflect this regularity. Okay, so this way, what we end up with is that we have some some cool predictions about how response correlations should look like. And these response correlations are actually related to our contextual primers. Again, one can fight for beautiful experimental validation, and we can find that. The last one is hierarchical inference. So this is a huge topic, and I will just touch it very briefly. So whenever we consider what's going on in the brain, clearly what happens there is that we are losing information. So what's happening there is that there's some sort of lossy compression going on. When we study the theory of lossy compression, we realize that what's happening in lossy compression is that there is no single optimal solution. Rather, there is a continuum of solution given depending on what sort of resources we have to do the encoding of a stimulus. And what we end up with is that the fidelity of the responses can change, but the other thing that can change in the other direction is what sort of invariances we are learning about our environment. So the idea is that when we go over the hierarchical processing stages of the visual cortex, what's happening there is that we are somehow going down in this rate distortion, because initially we encode things with high fidelity, with high rate, and then we learn these inferences as we go higher and higher in the hierarchy. The distortion will be higher. The responses will be more invariant to some nuisance parameters. For instance, high level nuisance parameter, what is the lightning conditions here are, and despite or irrespective of the lightning conditions, you will be able to recognize me. On a lower layer, one can beautifully show that in V1 and V2, this is the sort of gradual compression that is happening in the lower visual layer. Individual stimuli can be better discriminated, while at the higher layers, some factors like texture families can be better discriminated. So these were just sort of three computational motifs, which one is approximate inference, the other one is contextual prior, the third one is lossy compression in visual models, which are such that it can be somehow used to better understand and better read the neural code. As a last slide, I will just show you some outlook that is very exciting these days. So imagine that you have some theories on what sort of optimization is going on in the brain, and you have some beautiful mathematical expression. In physics, there's a beautiful tradition of building some tools that can be used by the community to answer deep and fun questions. Now, these days, neuroscience are getting to the speed. So this one is not a launch pad for little animals to put on orbit. Rather, this is a recording rig in which there is this mouse, and people can record thousands of neurons at the same time from different brain regions. And the fun in this is that this OpenScope project operated by the Allen Institute, one can see put in applications to perform particular experiments. If you can convince that this particular mathematical formula is interesting for them, then they will do the experiment, and you will end up with this beautiful data set. So this is pretty much it. So this is how we work. This how we try to address how the brain codes, and this is how we try to get closer to to read the neural code to understand the mathematics of the neural code. And finally, I will just acknowledge the contributions of my lab. These are just the current members of the lab and the funding sources. Thank you for your attention.
Thank you very much. Questions, ladies and gentlemen?
In the beginning of the talk, of your talk, you have mentioned that when we solve tasks, when we do linear algebra, what do you think about that?
Okay, so it's a beautiful question. So the idea is something like this. So when we look at how, for instance, images look like at the level of retina, then what we see is that just minuscule changes in position, in orientation, or whatever will result in very, very different activations of photoreceptors. And the goal of this hierarchy of the nervous system can be phrased as trying to identify the relevant variables, and these relevant variables will be transformed in a way that these will be linearly readable. So along the hierarchy, we find that with these inferences that the hierarchy discovers, this could be more and more linearly readable. One can identify different forms of linearity. For instance, one can identify linearity in terms of temporal lines. One can see that the higher levels in the visual cortex, those trajectories that object travels in the neural space are getting more and more linear. And also like the manipulations that we do, for instance, when we let's put it this way. So when we learn a task, a complex task, a good representation is such that in this task the relevant variables will be linearly represented. For general tasks, the nervous system has solved this problem. For some, it seems that it can learn this sort of linear algebra.